You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Brian Callen / Hunter Mott Show. Our guest is Professor Nick Bostrom. He's written a book called Superintelligence. He is a professor of philosophy at Oxford University. And in 2009 and in 2015, he was included in Foreign Policy's Top 100 Global Thinkers. He'd never tell you that, though, because he's Swedish, and the Swedes are very, very modest when talking about themselves and all things Sweden. And I really enjoyed the book. Was unique right at the start because you open in your introduction saying, look, I may very well be off the mark here in my entire argument. But having said that, your book has taken people like Elon Musk and Bill Gates over to your side. And your side is suggesting that artificial intelligence and super machines could very well be the end of, you know, human beings as we know it, or at least they won't have any respect for their biological heritage. And you draw comparisons to how we treat animals. So I'm looking forward to getting into this very deep conversation about the future with you, Professor.
Thanks for inviting me.
Of course. What are the thing that struck me, and it's interesting that you're a professor of philosophy, because I thought to myself, there's no way to write this book without first thinking very deeply about what it means to be human. You know, so much of what I hear when I hear atheists talk, or when I hear, you know, people who are scientists, is they tend to try to reduce the human condition down to an algorithm. And do you think that's a fair criticism or critique of that side of the arena, and you know, in the thinking arena?
Well, I think a lot of people simplify. It's kind of unavoidable.
Yeah,
especially if one is trying to think about very complex issues.
Right, and I don't think you do that, by the way. I'm just saying that.
Oh, I am too. Like,
oh, you admit? Oh, I didn't. I thought you did a good job of.
But there's you know, this real techno-utopian strain that we hear from Ray Kurzweil that like AI is going to come along and everything's going to be amazing, and you're saying that's not necessarily true.
Right. Yeah, we don't know that. That's going to be the case. So a lot of the, a lot of the pages in the book are about possible risks from machine superintelligence. I should stress, though, that I also think that there is an enormous upside that AI could be used to do an immense amount of good. And I'm really excited about that as well. It just seemed more pressing when I was writing the book to try to get a detailed understanding of exactly what could go wrong and how, so that we can make sure to avoid that. Whereas it seemed to me that we could maybe get by with a more general vague sense for the exciting opportunities. And then we can, if we avoid all the pitfalls, we will eventually like have a lot of time to work out exactly how we want to use all the wonderful opportunities. But I think that it might be good to try to correct that impression that some readers might come away with, that I'm actually more of a downer than I am when it comes to the future of AI.
No, but you're saying if you're going to bring the owl into the sparrow's colony, we better know a lot about how to tame an owl. I love that.
Yeah, that seems like a good thing to do. Develop the owl taming technology.
Yeah, would you mind telling that story just for our listeners? The story of the owl and the sparrows.
Well, you pretty much already reached the punchline there, but yeah, so it's a little allegory that I start off the book with, where one owl has the bright idea that it would be really convenient to have an owl working for the colony, who could keep an eye out for the neighborhood's cat, you know, help them with various chores. And they all get really excited and set off on a quest to find maybe an abandoned owl egg or an owl chick, or perhaps a baby weasel or some other animal might also do. But there is this one sparrow who's not convinced, Skronkfinkel. and he tries to voice some obvious objections to this scheme, but he's overruled. The other sparrows are already off, you know, looking for the owl egg. And so Skunkfinkel is left with a couple of colleagues to try to do their best work they can of figuring out what you would actually do if this owl.
Yeah, and of course the risk is the owl could turn around and eat all the sparrows. But here's always been my argument, always as if I've been thinking about this forever. but I do think that here is something that I think is not addressed enough in when people talk about AI and the idea that machines will start building better versions of themselves and so then be more concerned about their survival and procreation. And if humans are deemed a threat, they'll get rid of humans or use human beings as we do animals for tools, etc. There are a lot of doomsday scenarios. Oh. My issue, though, is this. Human beings, and the fundamental difference is that human beings know there's an end. Human beings know we are going to die. And human beings have always looked, you know, for immortality. We've always been looking for the fountain of youth. You've got Kurzweilists, guys like Ray Kurzweil say, hey, we're going to be able to download your brain into a computer and you'll live forever. And I think the conceit there is the idea that you think I'm not talking about you, but I'm saying someone like Ray Kurzweil actually thinks you can ultimately figure out what it means to be a human being in all its mystery. Human beings are driven by the fact that they know they're going to die. How in the world could you program grief into a machine? We use animals, yes, but remember, animals were such an existential threat. Microbes, bacteria, birds, rodents that ate our crops, mountain lions and wolves that killed our livestock, coyotes that killed our chickens. It goes on and on. Grubs that killed our potatoes. So there was a constant battle just to feed our families and survive against nature. Forget just the wind and the rain and all that stuff. So I don't know that computers, number one, will ever feel like they're going to die, because they're not. And also, why would we think that a computer would even find a human being, these super machines, why would they even find a human being not only a threat but even useful? So
I mean, there's a lot of things there. Maybe we can take a few of them. So I don't think that they would find human beings useful in the longer term. I think the model is more something like, we want to build a parking lot somewhere. There happens to be an ant colony there, so maybe they get paved over or destroyed. But it's not because we hate the ants or have any resentment to them. It's just because
they're in the way.
They weren't factoring into our objective function.
Mm. That makes sense. That makes sense. So, in other words, rather than there being sort of a specific and sort of animosity toward human beings, that will just be in the way or not even a factor in their multiplication or in their...
Right. If we don't do our jobs properly in terms of developing this kind of AI-controlled technology and safety research that we need, then they could end up with a utility function, a preference function that would not place value on our well-being or our existence, in which case we would just be objects in the world that you need to take into account in the short run to maybe prevent some human from switching off. But once you are powerful enough, then would be irrelevant.
But why would machines? We know why human beings want to procreate and want to live forever, because we're very aware that we are this biological machine that I'm living in is withering, and it's going to deteriorate and finally turn to dust in the end. That is not a concern for a machine. It never will be, really, or will it? And why would we think that machines
can die? Like, I mean, I had a laptop that died ignominiously not too long ago. So suppose you take some, to illustrate this, let's make it more concrete. Let's suppose you have an AI with some goal. Let's say the goal to make as many paperclips as possible. Maybe we designed this to run a paperclip factory and then it became super intelligent, but it still has this goal to maximize the number of paperclips. Now, this AI will have an instrumental reason to care about its own survival, because it can predict that if it is still around in the future, it will at that point in the future be trying to make paperclips, and probably there will be more paperclips in the world than if it is destroyed. And so even though it doesn't care about survival for its own sake, it's useful as a means to achieving more paperclips. And so now, instead of the goal of paperclips, you could plug in most other conceivable goals you might imagine, and they will tend to have these instrumental sub-goals of survival, of accumulating more resources, of becoming more intelligent.
Mm. That's interesting.
And so that's the concern, that there are these convergent instrumental reasons to achieve various states in the world that might not be consistent with the survival of human civilization.
Well, and fundamentally, I mean, it's all a competition for resources, right? I mean, you know, you talk a lot in the book about, you know, them essentially breaking out into space. But obviously, in order for them to be able to do that, they first need to make the most of the resources on the planet Earth. And there is inevitably going to be a competition for resources, just as there is a competition between ants and humans for that parking lot space. There's going to be a competition between humans and AIs for the resources of the planet.
Right, unless you have a very, very special kind of goal. Like if the AI's goal actually, let us say, is the same as ours, then it would obviously fail to achieve its goal if it killed us or harmed us, because we don't want that. So if you have an AI that's essentially on your side, then this problem is obviated.
But thinking about it from a biological perspective, you can't assume that there's not going to be some sort of mutation at some point. Even if you initially start out and program in that goal of, you know, that is aligned with human happiness, right? You talk about, you know, hedonium and all of this stuff. But even if you start off with that inevitably, isn't it going to reach a point where there will be some sort of mutation or variant that drops that out as non-essential?
I don't think necessarily. Like, once you have a sufficiently high level of technological capability, it should be possible, in particular, to prevent goal system corruption. That is, if you want to make a copy of a piece of software, even today, you usually succeed in making a flawless copy. And you can use error correcting code, you can do multiple proofreads, and you can do various things that will kind of arbitrarily reduce the probability of a mutation in the copy. And an AI would recognize the essential importance of doing that if it were spawning copies of itself. If the overall achievement of its goal was on the line here, it might take great precautions to prevent errors from slipping in.
But in order to have super intelligence, I mean, that was the other big thing is, you know, what is human intelligence? And that was one of the conversations that Brian and I had before the show, because we've had a lot of people on the show like, you know, Joseph Henrich, who, you know, the real sort of insight, right? A lot of the sort of the versions of AI that you're describing are very much sort of an enlightenment version of human intelligence, where you're going to have this hyper rational individual, this one super genius. And the model that has sort of emerged out of biology is that individuals are not particularly smart, but that what happens is that you have this hive mind that emerges, and what the real intelligence of humans is the ability to acquire culture over time and to have those cultures mutate and change until you end up with sophisticated cultural packages that are passed on. And if that's the case, then I think that in order to have a truly intelligent machine, you have to allow for evolution and you have to allow for mutation. And as soon as you allow for mutation, then you can no longer control the direction that it takes.
Yeah, I think that the evolution and mutation is a separate thing. I mean, it might be useful to have an architecture that has many different components, in a sense, like humanity has many different individuals. You could have an AI that has many different modules within itself, if that were an efficient way to process the information. It doesn't mean, though, that in terms of the final goal that it was pursuing, that it would want to risk any corruption or deviation from that. You could have a great multiplicity of different parts doing the thinking and analysis, trying out different ideas, soaking up different perspectives, without having the goal module itself.
But see, it'd be very difficult to have a machine comprehend what we don't comprehend ourselves. So In other words, I was thinking about this. I was laughing my friend was looking at this woman. And she was a makeup artist, and she was very overweight. And he likes women that are in really good shape. And I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I don't know what it is, man. I'm attracted to that girl, and I'm attracted to her in a dirty way." And he went through some very dirty fantasies, and they were kind of like, and I looked at him, he goes, I know, I don't get it. And he walked away. And I thought to myself, yes, well, we've all had emotions we can't understand, we can't explain. You can't explain to me why, there's so many things why I feel incredibly sad and yet joyous when I listen to a great piece of music. My friend's 87 years old, and he had a birthday party, and he was singing. And his voice is failing him. He's this wonderful old man who was a great singer back in the day, but he's 87. His body's breaking down. And a woman was watching him, and she was crying. And she didn't even know him, but she was crying because it was so kind of glorious that this guy at 87 still wasn't giving up. There are these things about human beings that are such a mystery, and we still can't figure out really what turns somebody off, what turns somebody on. Why does somebody get turned on when they get turned off? I hate that I'm attracted to that person. He's a scumbag. You'll hear a woman say, he's disgusting, yet I want to have sex with him. There are these so many of these sort of, and I know you as a philosopher, probably this is no mystery to you. You probably think about this a lot. But could you talk a little bit about that and whether or not that's even a factor in your fears about AI? I'm sorry. That was a lot of examples.
Yeah, what I mean I'm trying to think about where
the endless mystery of human beings.
There's a lot of things that we do understand about, say, human sexual desire. Like it's, from an evolutionary point of view, not random that majority of adults find the opposite sex attractive of childbearing age rather than, say, insects or trees or plants or something like that. Out of all the possible objects, there is like obviously a strong bias.
Speak for yourself.
The object that is would have been reproductively relevant in the ancestral context.
I see.
But it's also the case that there are, even with the AI we have today, cases where they might have intuitions and make judgments that we don't precisely understand. AlphaGo was this game AI that defeated the human champion Lee Sedol just recently in the game of Go. And AlphaGo has a kind of visual intuition. It can look at the Go board and figure out where is a promising looking place to place the next stone. Let's explore that further. Something quite analogous, I think, to human intuition. And it's not obvious exactly. I mean, we know the underlying algorithms that drive AlphaGo, but
isn't that pattern recognition, Professor? Isn't that just a higher level of pattern recognition, kind of like chess?
Yeah, but I mean, who knows whether or not that might also have been the case with your friend in this episode that you told us. Maybe there was some pattern that stimulated his desire for.
I think you mean a psychological trigger or whatever it might be.
It
right?
could have been like maybe some fertility clues or maybe some recollection of some other earlier experiences he has had. I don't know, but pattern recognition certainly was a part of it, I'd imagine.
What about grief?
What about it?
Well, what about grief and how would a machine ever, how can you even conceive of a machine ever feeling grief?
Would you necessarily want the machine to feel grief?
Well, but I think that's the sort of the big dividing line that we're dealing with here is that, there's this idea of intelligence that a lot of this AI is talking about, which essentially denigrates social intelligence. And what a lot of the biology is saying is that the whole basis of human success and the reason why we've been able to distance ourselves from the apes is because we have social intelligence. I mean, when you do an IQ test on a chimp, an orangutan, and a human toddler, when you get into spatial reasoning or when you get into, sort of causal reasoning, there's no difference between the chimp, the orangutan, and the toddler. The area in which the toddler stands out is social intelligence. So I mean, I think that's what's interesting is that, you know, God supposedly created man in his own image, and Silicon Valley is really trying to create AI in its own image, which is to be, you know, hyper value rational intelligence and to have a very low role for social intelligence. But I think that fundamentally misreads, you know, the story of human evolutionary success. And so grief is essential, right? You need loyalty. You need all of these sorts of things.
It's what drives us. It's the running away from pain and toward pleasure, or at least trying to stay alive for as long, which I still haven't seen. So, Professor, I guess what we're asking is that has to play a factor into the notion that we want to always stay alive, and we get rid of anything that is a threat to that. So we try to keep grief away from us. And if that means we have to kill somebody, i.e. terrorists or whatever it is, we do that. I don't know if I guess the argument I'm making is I find it difficult to see if a machine doesn't have grief, why it would care either way. And I get, you know, maybe you said it's the mission. I think you kind of answered that before, but maybe we could extrapolate a little bit more on that.
Yeah, well, let's think about this social intelligence point. I think it's kind of necessary for humans to have social intelligence because our brain is chopped up into small little pieces, each piece within one skull. So humanity's total brain mass is divided over 7 billion people. And the only way that we can achieve something significant is by trying to connect those little brain pieces together by talking and writing and so forth. But if you could have all of those brain pieces just in one big brain ball to begin with, then that might be much more efficient than kind of going through language, which, you know, seems impressive to us, but it's a lot lower bandwidth than, say, the bandwidth between your left hemisphere and your right hemisphere.
But it also, I think that's sort of where the science of human intelligence is starting to deviate from the sort of the Enlightenment idea, is that actually, because you talk in the book about satisficing, and, you know, part of what emerges from all this evolutionary biology is that you could continue to make the human brain bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, but you don't necessarily get better returns. You get better returns by having more individuals who aren't necessarily super intelligent, but who have the idea, who have the ability to, you know, have different ideas that combine, recombine, compete, they fight, they die, they do all of that sort of stuff. And then, you know, over time, what we've seen is greater cooperation. That's what the last 10,000 years have really been about, so that we find more and more effective ways to communicate those ideas. But I think that's the big question about AI is, does AI end up being, you know, this sort of one massive collected 7 billion brains all together in one blob, or does it end up looking remarkably like us in the sense that it has to have these emotions and it has to have these feelings and it has to have this social intelligence so that it can, you know, fight for different, because presumably there will be different visions of how do you achieve that goal. Even if it is the paperclip thing, you're going to have different visions of how do you achieve that, and you're going to have rival factions that compete and try and show the merit of their strategy.
Professor?
Well, I do have a long chapter on multipolar outcomes where you have not just one big uber intelligence, but a lot of different ones that compete. I think that's a real possibility, but I don't think it would be because of the reasons you say. I think it would be because of coordination failures that you just have competing entities developing their own AIs. There's a general principle, which is that if you have a lot of serial computing power, you can always use that to simulate a lot of different. You could do time sharing, so you could use your fast serial processor to simulate a parallel system, whereas it's not always easy to take a parallel system and simulate the serial system. So if you had one big, really big blob, and for some reason it was useful to have a lot of smaller modules, then that big blob could simulate within itself a lot of these different smaller modules. Whereas we humans have great trouble kind of putting all our little pieces together. If that seems useful, we can't really just meld into one big blob.
I love
so
the way
I think that the big AI would have the opportunity, to whatever extent it seemed useful, to subdivide its big mind into smaller minds, if that helped solve various kinds of problems.
But, I mean, we do have the ability to meld into one big blob. I mean, that's what nations are, that's what armies are, and specifically there's an emotion called transcendence, which allows people to be lifted up into a single collective intelligence and then act and, you know, attack a threat, very much like a swarm of bees. So, I just think the larger question is our social intelligence, are our emotions, are they a bug or are they a feature? And the tendency of the Enlightenment is to think that emotions are sort of this inconvenient bug that gets in the way of rationality and critical thinking and all of that sort of stuff. And you'll hear people like Richard Dawkins, you know, they think that even though that 99% of the world is religious, that that's a bug. And the interesting thing that's coming out of a lot of this evolutionary biology is to say, well, when it happens that often, it actually turns out to be a feature. And, you know, it's partly the chaos of the capitalist market that allows it to be so innovative. And I think that's the interesting thing is, are we, is the solution to having super intelligence, you know, having a massively ordered system, or is it allowing for chaos and then allowing the best solution to emerge?
I mean, what is a bug or a feature in one system might not be the same as what is a bug or a feature in another system. So all this adaptation to social life is a feature if you're actually a small person living in a social context with a lot of similar people. It doesn't mean that it's necessarily a helpful feature if the alternative would be to have a monolithic AI architecture. I think the other part there is the motivation, like some of this you mentioned, efforts to try to get different humans lined up. It's not just the communication barrier, the difficulty of sharing ideas, which is very time-consuming and limited. I know as an author, I kind of have a keen awareness of how slow and inefficient linguistic communication is. But then with humans, we have the additional problem of wanting different things. So we are actually working positively at cross purposes to one another. One mm-hmm. group of human is trying to defeat and destroy what another group of human is trying to create and build up.
Right.
So sometimes the whole is less than the sum of its parts. There's no particular reason to think that the global social architecture that we humans have now in the year 2016 is anywhere close to the optimal, even for what we humans could achieve, let alone for a sort of an arbitrarily architectured, intelligent system.
Yeah. Professor, I'm sorry.
I have to run off in a couple of minutes, I'm afraid.
Okay, one of the things that, you know, when you look at our nuclear arsenal, we already have and have had for many years the ability to destroy the globe five times over. Do you think that AI will be safeguarded in the same way? I know that's kind of what you're calling for to an extent, and it's going to be much harder because these are not physical missiles. But to an extent, human beings are pretty good at making sure, even with all their differences, that they don't eradicate themselves completely. What do you think of that?
I wouldn't necessarily agree that we are very good at it. I mean, we haven't yet annihilated ourselves.
Yeah.
I think that's about as much as I would grant in that direction. I think we haven't had a means to do it yet, basically. And the closest we had to a means of doing that was our thermonuclear weapons, which we came close enough to fire several times during the Cold War, just in a few decades.
Yes,
that we've had
true.
Them. So,
that's very true. We came. We had some close calls. We definitely had some close calls. Do you think though that? Do you, in writing this book and thinking about this stuff as a philosopher, and did this make you in some ways more religious, less religious? Do you ever wonder what the whole point of this? It's almost like, do you find yourself reading the Book of Revelations and going, maybe there was some truth to this?
I thought about some of these things before writing the book, but I guess on the margin, probably more. I mean, just... you realize that there is quite possibly a lot more in heaven and on earth than is dreamt of in our philosophy. Like how small we current humans are in this big scheme of things in different dimensions. And so it just makes one perhaps a little bit more humble about extrapolating from our current limited set of experiences to the entire world past, present, future, different dimensions, different levels of simulated reality, etc. It just makes one feel kind of small.
Yeah, no doubt. That's what the book does and does very well, and it's a great book. So, congratulations on it's such an ambitious effort, and you've obviously been very successful, and the book raises all kinds of incredible questions. And so we appreciate you taking the time. I know you have to go, but bravo. It's a brave book to write. It really is. And it's ambitious. It's rare that you see somebody who takes on a task like this. You know, I more power to you. It sounds like it's going to be a question you're going to be answering and wrestling with for many years to come.
That seems likely, yes.
Well,
thank you, then.
We need you, though. We need people like you to kind of pull back the rug and look at all these things. Before you go, in the next 10 years, can you give us a peek into what you expect from artificial intelligence and the good things we have to look forward to besides self-driving cars?
Well, I think that at the moment there is rapid advances in perceptual intelligence, so the ability to recognize the content of images and videos, to recognize speech. So I think that will be rolled out into different kinds of products and used to create better recommender systems, let us say, so that you can actually find more efficiently the people, the movies, the products that will be good for you. That's already happening, but I think there will be more of that. I'm not allowed to mention the self-driving car since you excluded that from the list of possible impacts.
Yeah.
It's a kind of a general purpose technology. So there are a lot of things, anything from healthcare diagnostics to scientific research, finding new drugs, entertainment, virtual reality things, transportation. There is hardly any sector where things couldn't be improved and done better by the application of smart software and artificial intelligence. So I think we will see a kind of diffused impact throughout the economy over the next 10 years.
Great. Well, Professor Nick Bostrom, the book is Superintelligence, Professor of Philosophy at Oxford University. God, I'd love to be a professor of philosophy at Oxford.
Brian.
I would wear tweed jackets. I'd have a German Shepherd by my side. Uh-huh. You're probably tall. You're probably just a tall Swede. But anyway, with a big brain. Sir, thank you so much for gracing us with your presence and your brain. We appreciate it.
Great. Toodles. Bye-bye.
Toodles.
Toodles. Like, you get to say that when you're an Oxford University professor.
Take care, sir.
Bye-bye.
Brian, I think you'd be a great professor. Do you think we could get the listeners to endow a chair for you?
The first thing I do is I'd be like, listen, all the guys, get the fuck out. Again, though, it's funny how it's very difficult to quantify what a human being is. It just is, and I don't think we've come close yet. I mean, we're scratching the surface, and even in the book he says, you know, the singularity or whatever you want to call it, it may not happen even in this century. We got a ways to go.
Well, we don't know how long we have to go, but I think the thing that's dangerous is, you know, the sort of the blind optimism of the Kurzweil camp.
Yeah, I do too, and I think that's why you need guys like Nick Bostrom.
Yeah.
You know? There's no question. But, Ray Kurzweil is so optimistic. I mean, the idea that he's literally ambitious enough to say, I believe that we can live forever.
Yeah, but that's what he wants to believe. I think that's the point, that he wants to believe that, and that doesn't really tell you anything about reality. It tells you about his desires.
Well, it's also the idea that, for example, I'm the same without my body. What are you talking about? I am my body. I mean, that's a huge part of the fact that I am everything I was talking about being funny. I mean, I'm funny because it's basically a long wail. It's a wail, a lament for the fact that I'm not who I want to be. I never will be. And someday I'm going to be fucking not. I will not be.
Yeah.
That's who I am.
Yeah.
So if you were to say, hey, Brian, you're going to live forever. And oh, by the way, you don't need your body. Oh, and by the way, I'll be able to download information into you so you can be a concert pianist in a couple of minutes. What are you talking about? What are you talking about? That's the farthest thing from being a human being I can think of.
But also,
all joy goes away. The whole idea of accomplishment is that it's really hard and that I'll never be close to perfect. But some days I look great on a tennis court. And in my mind, I'm playing close to Federer. And in other days, I'm a spaz and, you know, I my ankles hurt. It just... Come on, man.
I am fascinated by the idea of an AI whose ankles hurt, even though that doesn't have a body.
That's right. So am I. So am I. It goes back to grief. It goes back to joy.
Yeah.
You know, it goes back to all those. It goes back to having grief / joy.
Right. And the fact, I mean, I think that's the thing. You know, death drives people to be creative and to try things and to, you know, insecurities, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
You know.
It does. Why would you play why would you learn how to play the violin just to make beautiful music?
I mean, Kurzweil writes all those books and is advocating all of this stuff precisely because he's afraid to die.
He takes 1,000 pills a day.
Yeah. He's afraid.
His pill regimen is something insane. Yeah. You seen how much it costs?
It's how much?
Hundreds of thousands of dollars.
A year?
Yeah, yeah, just to afford the pills he takes.
What's
it was
his
literally
breakfast?
Something like it was almost $1.2 million. I can't remember what the exact amount was, but Kurzweil's pill regimen is so ridiculously expensive.
Wow.
His breakfast.
Kurzweil's immortality diet.
Let's see.
This is his breakfast: berries, dark chocolate infused with espresso, smoked salmon and mackerel, vanilla soy milk, stevia, porridge, and green tea.
I take that.
Oh, he takes 100 pills a day, down from 250 a few years ago.
It's got to be processed by his liver.
Allegedly thanks to advances in technology. Yeah, pretty amazing.
100 pills a day.
100 pills a day.
Yeah.
He used to have to take 250. How long do you think it takes you to swallow 250 pills?
I'm not going to live that long, so it doesn't matter.
Do you think some of them, and that's the thing I wonder, like some of them are probably like horse pills. They're huge.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. That's pretty terrifying.
I mean, the guy is very smart and he probably knows a lot more than I do about health. And not probably, he definitely does.
Yeah.
But it's a little bit like I'm writing this joke about I'd read this many articles as I do about the evils of sugar. And I'm sitting next to this woman who eats. She had two cookies and I was judging her. And I was like, you would eat two cookies on a plane. Oh, no, thank you. I'll stay very empty. My pancreas is taking a rest. I plan on living longer than Cookie Girl over here. And I was like, and then 20 minutes later, she took a nap. And I went, you needed a nap. You needed a nap. I'm wide awake, but I guess you had a crash, loser. And I could barely look at her. And then I realized I'm annoyed at somebody because they ate two cookies and took a nap. Fuck is wrong when they talk about being a crank.
No, you know, but
and I want to apply my knowledge to the whole world, because if the world knew what I knew, but they'd be healthy.
But
what
that's
a joke.
That's religion, and that's
of
the
course
point.
It is. And
that's
we're all religious.
And that's the thing, and that's what Kurzweil is. He has a weird religion, but it's just that instead of popping one piece of bread in your mouth, you have to pop 100 pills in your mouth every day.
I'm the a-hole. I'm just as bad as anybody I criticize. I'm on a plane again. Woman's reading a gossip rag.
Yeah.
And I'm reading Cormac McCarthy or Nick Bostrom's book or whatever. And I'm awesome because I live in the real world. I'm working with real ideas. This one over here to my right is part of the problem, not this guy.
Mm-hmm.
This guy's, I'm taking on the mantle of knowledge. I know that one cannot escape the responsibility of being a human being. I've read Seneca, for God's sake. Meanwhile, she has a couple cookies and I'm like, yeah, whatever, Cookie Girl. Can't wait till you take a nap. She didn't take a nap. I ended up taking a nap.
Oh,
I was like,
damn it.
But I read that the human brain needs a nap. So this one's going to stay awake. I'm going to ungunk my brain and take a nap and live longer.
That's right.
So now I'm annoyed at her for not taking a nap. Then there's a woman who's sick in the back of the plane. She goes, I'm an ER nurse. I can help. I went, you're an ER nurse?
Yeah.
She saves lives. She lives real life.
So now you're lesser.
I'm a piece of shit.
Yeah.
Look, at the end of the day, I'm learning it as I get older. Not to think that what I know would benefit all of humanity.
But except that it would. Well, secretly, you know that it would.
I think if I were emperor of the world, I would do a couple of things. I would figure out a way to stay completely out of everybody's lives.
Oh.
And I would have, I think you need security and law and order. That doesn't mean I would advocate gun control. I would just, maybe I'd let everybody carry a gun. I would just have maximum freedom, but you need laws. And I think I would kill con men. I don't like con men. I hate con men.
And so you would kill them.
I wouldn't kill them. I'd just put them in sweatshops and they'd have to work.
Can I ask you a dangerous question, though?
Yeah.
So a lot of people who have had, you know, ideas that have changed the world have first been viewed as con men.
Shit.
So how do you have innovation if you don't allow for con men?
Well, you'd be my chief of staff.
Oh, that's good. So it'd be my job to sort it out.
Yeah, because I tend to fly off the handle and you'd bring me back.
Yeah.
And ultimately we'd end up doing nothing. We'd just be debating. We'd have this podcast and hope people listen to it. And if people, I know people, they even though I was the emperor of the world, they'd be like,
you
I'm not
just
listening
podcast.
To that a-hole. You really wonder what you would do with a lot of power. Right. I would try. I hope at 49 years old, I would have learned my lesson not to do almost anything. You know?
Yeah, but I don't think that is the solution. I think the you know, it's you need. I think that's what in general a lot of these guys don't understand. The sort of the children of the Enlightenment. Like you need chaos. You need chaos in order to have innovation and to have
really
progress
do.
And all of that stuff. But then you have to create boundaries for that chaos. We don't want that chaos to turn violent. So you remove the possibility of violence from the equation. Right.
Yeah, or at least the violence is simulated violence,
yeah.
Right? So UFC fighting, boxing,
sure.
And all that, yeah. But you're right. I mean, bombs going off in marketplaces and children dying is not
helpful.
It's not helpful.
Helpful chaos.
You've got to figure out a way to vaccinate your population.
That's right.
You've got to figure out a way to fight bad ideas like anti-vaccination or,
yeah.
You know, whatever, or antibiotics are the devil, you know, whatever it is. There's got to be ways to, you're always going to have to fight waves of ignorance.
Yeah.
With information, though.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
But also, I mean, that's part of the problem of having, you know, scientists who don't value social intelligence.
Because they don't know how to get their message out there.
No.
Yeah.
And the people who do value social intelligence are really good at getting their message out there. Did you see this? Joe Rogan posted a thing about some preacher in Africa who said that he went up to heaven and took a photo of it with his Galaxy Samsung.
Sure did see that. I sure did.
And then he denied it, but because, yeah. You know, he would never be so disrespectful to Jesus as to bring his cell phone to heaven.
I know.
But anyway, I think, you know, Brian, I think you'd be a great...
That's good reception, though, to get reception up in heaven.
No, I mean, amazing.
Well, you think I'd be a great emperor?
I think you'd be a great emperor, because I think fundamentally you would do what none of these other people would do, which is listen.
No, I just have sex a lot. My wife would have to understand because I'm the emperor.
Right.
And she'd have everything she wanted, but I'd be like, listen, don't be a baby about stuff.
Yeah. But would you allow her to have affairs?
Only if I could videotape it. And,
you would allow that.
I mean, I hate hypocrites, so I think I'd have to allow it. I mean, but they'd have to be very, they'd have to have very small penises and be very short and not muscular at all. Just because I'm sexually competitive.
Understandably, yeah. Understandably, and reasonably
yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, you wonder.
You know what the Emperor Augustus's wife used to do, right?
No.
She had a very, very simple strategy. She had as many fares as she wanted, but she made sure that she never, you know, went to sea unless the boat was already fully loaded. So she would only have an affair when she was pregnant.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. She's pretty smart.
When I was a young man, I met a girl and I had a little affair with her and in her, as in I met her and I right in her hotel room, and she had a pregnant friend who was like 4 months pregnant. And it was made clear to me that El Prego wanted to have sex with me as well.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm not doing that, man.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't know whose baby it was. I just didn't know if she was with a guy. And also, I just didn't want to.
Wow.
I had this other girl.
I'm sure that made the pregnant
one
feel great.
They were from Chicago, and they had heavy Chicago accents.
Yeah.
They were talking, you know, and she said, "You're cack." She referred to me. Anyway, sorry, guys.
So what if she had...
We just had Nick Bostrom on. Now I'm talking about this stuff. I don't know why. Anyway.
Well, but it sort of goes back to the point, is that...
Being the emperor.
Yeah, but also, do you need... Well, A, I think that's the interesting thing, right? A lot of this stuff is predicated on the idea that you want an AI that is essentially an emperor, an all-powerful, right, single, massive intelligence.
Well, no, that's the problem is that, you know, I feel like politically you've got one side like Nick, you know, Ted Cruz and people like Michael Malice, who we love, and who say there should be no government, really,
right,
or very little. And then you have Hillary Clinton and especially Bernie Sanders, who's not a socialist communist. He wants to tax people 90% of their income, you know, in some instances. So Bernie Sanders is not a very, in my opinion, smart guy. Bernie Sanders just has one idea. Let's take from the rich and redistribute wealth. Well, okay. And then I suppose I can mount a bunch of historical arguments for why that doesn't work. And he would have his rebuttals and we'd get nowhere. He would probably laugh and I would, you know, and then something would happen, but nothing would happen. So I'm never going to change Bernie Sanders' mind, and I'm not going to change young people's minds either necessarily, because the idea of free college and healthcare is a right and housing is a right. But great, I agree with all that. Who's going to pay for it, and what kind of a central enforcement agency are you going to have to make sure that that all happens?
But see, I think the great thing that is built into all of this, yeah, is that you have to win these people over to your ideas.
Well,
right?
Or Michael Malice had it right, which was maybe both sides are working on an outdated model.
Oh, they are. There's,
yeah,
no doubt that they are. But
I mean, even Bernie Sanders has admitted he doesn't know how he would do all these things.
Well, and I mean, a lot of this comes back to like what Bostrom is talking about, which is the reality is that manual labor increasingly no longer has any value. Like, you can't sell your manual labor anymore.
That's right.
It's going to have, you know, you
unless you massage and give release.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
not that I do.
But
that.
Wait a minute, Brian. So are you saying?
But seriously, like manual labor
is
sexually...
this your job creation platform?
Well, I think that there will always be room for, you know,
release
prostitution,
the oldest job in the world.
Yeah, and I mean, manufacturing is going by way of automation, but there's no robot that's going to take the place of.
You wouldn't get released from a robot.
I prefer somebody in high heels with low self esteem and daddy issues as I get older.
But so
I hope my wife doesn't listen to this shit.
But,
she's going to kill
me. Brian, well, I mean, that's the thing. You just hope that she like tunes out as soon as Nick Bostrom gets.
My wife has very high self esteem, but it doesn't mean I can't put her in high heels and make her call me daddy.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
As the emperor of the world. As she rolls her eyes.
But listen.
Hey, tell me you don't like yourself. Tell me. I know you do. But just say it.
But Brian, this is actually, I mean, this is brilliant. You found the one job that, you know, can't be automated.
I agree. Yes.
Yeah. And
damn right.
So until the
Japanese come up with some of those crazy robots.
Sex robot.
But
yeah.
Even then, you can't simulate.
It's not going to be the same. People aren't going to want that.
I won't.
No. And so what you're dealing with is that Brian's plan for the future is that all traditional jobs will be done by robots. And then also because you can't export that job, right? Mm. Like, you can't outsource that job. I don't want like a video link,
yeah,
massage with release. I want like the real deal.
Of course.
So, you know, you're going to make America great again
by
sex workers.
I sure am.
Everyone will
be a
sex worker.
The idea that sex work is illegal is outrageous.
That's really, I mean, that's what we want.
I know it exploits the women, blah, blah, blah.
No, but I mean, male sex workers is you have more and more, you know, powerful female CEOs. You know, they may want male sex workers.
Of course they do.
You'd be a great sex worker.
Women, I know a lot of women. I know plenty of wealthy and powerful women that are shameless, and God bless them. So yeah, please.
I think that's Brian. This is really brilliant.
Thank you, buddy.
You've really solved.
Well, that's what this show is about: cracking the case. It's about solving the big problems.
That's the thing. You've really engaged with the problem, which is, you know, automation, and, you know, rather than just dredging up socialism or whatever the hell Trump believes, you know, you're like sex work. That's the answer.
I feel like a lot of times we're over here talking. Everybody's talking about how to solve problems, or we're talking about the problem, when the black swan is there's going to be some invention, some AI, something that's going to come along and just rearrange the entire equation and the board.
It already is.
Yeah. So all of a sudden we've been talking over here and wait, I mean, what the hell is this? You know, plenty of people had plans until World War I came along and World War II came along and... Yeah, so...
But you can't... I mean, you know, it's Einstein's old thing. You can't solve problems with the same way of thinking that created them.
That's a great quote.
Yeah.
And that's probably very true.
And all of the political candidates are basically dusting off old ways of thinking, and they just don't apply. They're not relevant.
They don't. You know, I think it's interesting too, because as somebody who was force-fed the Reagan doctrine as a kid,
you mean the truth?
I have an emotional attachment to all things, you know, Reagan and small government, because I love my father, and I think my father's a very fair-minded man and a good man and very smart and has worked very hard at developing a philosophy. So I admire that. So of course there's a part of me that wants to be like that. But look, I mean, I was listening to Alec Baldwin's podcast. Here's the thing, and he had I think the chairman, the Coalition for the Homeless. She was a chairman, and she was an Irish gal from I think New York, and you know, she said something interesting. She said, "Look, housing is a right. There are people who are for a lot of reasons. Maybe it's because they have an alcohol abuse problem. Maybe it's because they have mental health issues. They can't take care of themselves. They can't. They are just on the street. And if you don't believe me, go take a look at Skid Row. You know, say whatever you will. The fact is that there are people that become wretches. And I thought to myself, I mean, I'm so lucky for no reason. I had great parents. I had good biology. I don't suffer from mental illness. I don't have a need to drink. I'm just lucky, 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 lucky. I don't care what I had nothing to do with fucking self-discipline, or I can't stand that talk anymore. So I believe in self-reliance and personal responsibility, and I can wax poetic about what makes this country great and talk about Thomas Jefferson and freedom. But, you know, I don't want to live in a society that has people who can't take care of themselves fighting on the street, dirty, shamed, forsaken, and forgotten. I don't want to live in that world. So I really appreciate these quote-unquote liberals like this woman or Alec Baldwin who are saying, I like freedom too, but I don't like this. You know, this woman's brother committed suicide when he was a young guy. So she has a very different reality and a very deep understanding, probably emotionally, of what it means to be helpless, how hard it is to help somebody who has mental illness, and how hard it is for them to help themselves. And so, you know, as I get older, I find myself really questioning everything that I've I don't believe in socialism, and I don't believe in, you know, the state should come in. But, you know, sometimes what is the alternative? Right. What is the alternative besides figuring out a way to create free housing for our less fortunate?
And I think
families, 25,000 kids are homeless in New York City.
Right.
What are you going to do about that?
Well, and I think part of it, too, is in terms of, like, it says something about humanity. Like, it is a need for humanity to not see people suffering, right?
Like, for me, sure.
That's what I'm saying.
I don't like anything about my life when I think of people, like, I think of those Syrian refugees.
Right.
I have a Tesla.
Yeah.
I get in my Tesla and I go to my awesome house in Calabasas. I feed my children. My wife gets to ride horses. I actually don't like that feeling sometimes.
Right.
I feel like a pig.
But the point is that it requires wisdom to be able to fix that system without just throwing money at the problem.
That's right.
And so the goal, I mean, I think all of the goals are good, right? We want an economy that is innovative, that is competitive, that creates great things. We also don't want homeless people on the streets, you know, people who can't take care of themselves. We want to afford as much. I mean, human dignity is a valuable commodity, and it is one that we should, you know, try and raise anywhere we can.
Yeah.
And then the question is, and you have to include all perspectives and listen to as many people as possible to try and figure out, how do you solve that problem? How do you create a system that, you know, satisfies the desires of, you know, let's call them Reaganites, and, you know, that satisfies the desire of libtards, right?
Well, you know, Michael Malice falls in the middle with religion, right? That's why he's very hesitant to criticize religious people, because churches and synagogues and mosques and, you know, do a lot. They do a lot to help people that can't help themselves. I'm not. I'm too busy. I'm too busy making money or, you know, I don't know, writing or whatever, raising my own kids. I don't have time. You know, I wish I did, but I'm shamed by the fact that I don't do enough. I give. I have a couple of charities I give, I don't know, $40 a month to. Please,
yeah.
Please. I drank a lot of wine last night. My bill was hard to look at. I'm swollen in the face.
No, that's not true. Well, Brian, your face looks amazing.
I'm
right
a good looking guy.
Yeah.
The most important thing is that I retain my looks.
Yeah, it really, I mean, I you know, you asked Nick Bostrom about how he feels about, you know, God. And yeah. When I look at your face, I feel like there probably is one.
Is it the symmetry?
It is the symmetry, you know.
Will you help me with an audition?
Yeah, I would be honored to.
Oh, good.
Are we going to do it on the podcast?
Probably not, because we only have 5 minutes left and we should probably wrap this up. I'll get a jump start on it. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been Brian the Kid Callen and my colleague, the man who's much smarter than I am and seems to be able to remember everything, including names, Hunter, Tailpiece, Motz. And when I say Tailpiece, he's got an ass on him.
Yeah.
It's a big Dutch ass. Strong ass, though. He's built for the farm. Not the battlefield. He doesn't have the temperament. He's built for the
farm.
That
is probably true. Yeah.
Yeah. You're a member of are you people the tallest race in the world?
Yeah, that is true. That is true.
Even taller than the Maasai and the Sudanese?
Oh, I don't know. I'm the tallest nationality, but I don't know if you're talking about specific ethnic groups.
Yeah, cuz those Sudanese guys.
They're tall.
Hey guys, they're tall. You know what I mean? Yo, they're tall. Yo, those guys is tall.
Brian, how would you feel if when you're emperor, your wife had a Sudanese lover?
It'd be tough.
Because
I'm territorial.
Tall.
Well, he's been easy. He'll hit places I haven't.
Yeah, haven't.
I can't reach.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's a problem for me. So I would probably, I'd have to beat her.
Yeah.
I am the emperor. I know domestic violence.
Would you beat her, or would you have your Praetorian guard beat her for you?
Well, I would probably do it with like flowers. I would beat her with flowers.
Her
with rose petals.
Oh wow, that would really show her.
I'm gonna show you.
And then throw really expensive rose petals and silk at her.
I'm going to throw silk and rose petals at you until you can't take it anymore.
Until the softness and the luxury makes you realize all that I've given you.
That would get really painful after a while.
You think so? Silk?
Yeah,
and
I
rose
mean
petals?
Anything. It's like if you took an empty aerosol can and started hitting somebody lightly with it. After a while.
Yeah,
it's gonna make a mark.
Rose petals. You really think rose petals would?
Look, man, I don't have to answer these questions. I'm the emperor. Ladies and gentlemen.
But I'm kind of fascinated by this, Brian. I mean, I kind of want to just like, can we put you in a room full of rose petals with a fan and
after
just have
while,
you be.
Just get to you. You know?
Well,
like
I'm sure you'd be annoying, but
yeah.
It'd be like water torture.
Dub Davidoff compares it to swimming with dolphins.
Yeah, I love that.
You're in the pool. You're like, these dolphins are amazing. But after a half hour, you're like, can somebody give these dolphins a better personality? I saw you jump through a hoop. You feel like an olive, but I could give a shit. I'm cold. I want out. Yeah. Even swimming with dolphins gets old, ladies and gentlemen.
Wow.
And that is the message for today. Hunter Motz, always stimulating. Thank you. And thank you to Professor Nick Bostrom.
And Rena Marie.
Oh, and Rena Marie, of course.
Yeah.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.